This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day, powered by 2,600 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm June Grosso. On this edition of Bloomberg Best for Monday, April 24th, Eurasia Group founder Ian Bremmer comments on the French elections.
I expect the polls are going to narrow. Number one, it won't be the 20% slam dunk. And secondly, we have to watch how many people are really going to turn out. I think this is going to be more of a nail biter than people think.
Plus, Italian finance minister Pier Carlo Padoan also reacts to the results from the French election.
This is good news for France, for Europe, and for the global economy.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
In France, voters will now select between two radically different visions of the country's future. Centrist Emmanuel Macron and far-right nationalist Marine Le Pen won the first round of the presidential election. That sets up a runoff on May 7th. Eurasia Group founder Ian Bremmer talked about the election with Bloomberg's Alex Steele, David Weston, and Jonathan Farrow.
The story looks pretty good, but nowhere near as good as the markets presently accept, right? I mean, the idea that you're going to get a significant turnout or close to the turnout that you just had yesterday in a couple weeks' time when there's and the electorate's going to hear, oh, Macron's done. It's a win. So this, first of all, is not as much need for his core supporters to be out there. But secondly, a lot of people, particularly from the far left, Mélenchon, who absolutely are not going to be in favor of supporting an establishment candidate. He'll be seen as Hollande light, effectively. That's going to be a problem. And even though Fillon has said, yes, come out and be supportive, we're going to be voting for Macron, a lot of the right wing is going to be uncomfortable with that as well. So I expect the polls are going to narrow, number one. It won't be the 20% slam dunk. And secondly, we have to watch how many people are really going to turn out. I think this is going to be more of a nail biter than people think this morning.
And let's flash forward here to June and the parliamentary elections. What can we expect there? And then what does a France look like when you have a Macron in a party that doesn't exist in parliament?
Well, as of today, of course, both Le Pen and Macron, between the two of them, have three members of parliament that are actually sitting. So it shows you just how much of an anti-establishment vote this actually was in France. What it means is you have what they call a cohabitation. And so it means it's going to be no, Macron is a guy that clearly has a lot of great economic ideas, a lot of European integration ideas that the markets and the business community would love if he could get them done. But the idea that he's going to be able to create a base, a legislative base that would push any of this forward on the agenda is virtually zero. And so even presuming a Macron win, which I think is a reasonable, though not yet a completely safe bet, the idea that then now the French people have come together and we no longer have to worry about populism in France. No, this election is telling you you have to worry about populism in France. And, you know, the same way that it could have very easily have been no Brexit vote, it could have very easily have been no Trump vote in the United States, and then we wouldn't be talking about this. Because we pay attention to outcomes. We don't pay attention to these systemic underlying problems that grow, but that will eventually bite us in the butt, just in the same way we've ignored climate change for decades. That's precisely what is likely to happen here in France.
Are we going to get the sort of reform that most economists think have to happen in France?
Let me put it this way. If you're an investor looking at political risk in France right now, you can hear a pretty good story. If you're a corporate, you don't. Because long-term, young people in France don't think there are opportunities for them. Long-term, they're not developing the productivity. Long-term, we don't understand what's going to make this market sustainable and happy over the course of, sort of the 1-2 electoral cycles. This is not a win. No one can look at this election in France. No one can look at the process, at the state of play of who was actually out there, Hollande, at, you know, sort of in single-digit support, and say, this is something we like. Fundamentally, these countries, even if they're getting growth a little bit better right now, they look very uncomfortable in terms of the future of liberal democratic capitalism. That's what we all thought. That was a presumption. That's what we were all capitalists here, right? No, it turns out very few people have capital at risk, and they don't like what people like Mr. Macron actually stands for. Let's watch what just last night they had the election. People happy about Macron, and the major French media, they're all following him as if he's he's the next president. They go and they see him at this upscale bistro and celebrating and going railing on the journalists. The average individual is going to be as turned off by that as the average American is by the mainstream media in the U.S. right now.
Well, Ian, you said it yourself, he's probably going to win because he's actually just inoffensive compared to pretty much everyone else. Away from the intraday moves today, go forward several decades. Talk to me about the scars of two financial crises on a whole generation of youth, not just in France, in Greece, in Italy, in Spain, and what that's going to mean for the voting intentions of those individuals over the next several decades.
The Europe that we believed we had, the West we believed we had, with open values, open borders, with a sense of community, with nations that could actually integrate people from all over the world to be a part of it, is gone. If you can't address those things will fall away. And you know, you look, you think, well, what's the future? Who's developing the values for the next generations? It's hard for you to look in the United States and Europe. You'd be looking at China, you'd be looking at India, you'd be looking at emerging economies. That's a very bad message to be sending to the next generations.
That was Eurasia Group founder Ian Bremmer speaking with Bloomberg's Alex Steele, David Westin, and Jonathan Farrow. Coming up, we have more on the French elections when we speak to an advisor to one of the candidates, Marine Le Pen. You can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg. Independent Emmanuel Macron and far-right candidate Marine Le Pen advanced to the runoff on May 7th. It was the first time in modern French history that both the Republican and Socialist parties lost in the first round. Michael Sala is a business advisor for the National Front Party and advisor to Marine Le Pen. He spoke with Bloomberg's Caroline Conan.
There's not much we have to actually do to expand beyond our base because a lot of the voters who chose to vote for Mr. Fillon are patriots. And very naturally, they will turn to Marine Le Pen because of the two contenders, she definitely is the one who carries the French flag. Emmanuel Macron is known to be a pro-EU, is known to be pro-globalization in its fiercest form. So most of the patriots who voted for François Fillon, those who voted for Mr. Dupont-Aignan, will come to us. So there's not an intention to go after them. Marine will be who she is. You know, and what will make her win this election is that she's not defending interests like Mr. Macron. She is defending core beliefs, and those beliefs are shared by a vast majority of French, and this is what is going to win her that election.
We've seen that the communist-backed candidate Jean-Luc Mélenchon hasn't endorsed a specific candidate in this runoff. Is Marine Le Pen going to go after Jean-Luc Mélenchon's electorate as well?
A lot of the voters who chose Jean-Luc Mélenchon are very wearied with the fierce form of globalization, which imposes, you know, cutting jobs in Western Europe, especially in France, to create jobs elsewhere. You know, like Donald Trump said in his inauguration speech, we are sick of the wealth being stripped from the homes of our middle class in Western, you know, democracies. And that feeling is shared in France by a lot of the working people. And some of them chose Jean-Luc Mélenchon. And if they have a choice between Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen, no doubt they will go with Marine Le Pen because she offers, she promises, she has a promise, an economic promise to offer protection from savage globalization.
Obviously, we've seen the positive reaction on the markets today, assuming that Emmanuel Macron would win in the runoff. How come the business community does not understand your message then?
Well, I've spent a lot of time in the last 6 months speaking to the business community, and I can tell you one thing that you know and I know. They don't like change. They know, they agree to the fact that the euro is not, it doesn't make sense in economical terms. It makes sense, it's a political project to force convergence between countries who were divergent. They all know that. What they say is that the transition is going to take handling with a lot of care. We will handle with care. They don't like change. I understand their reaction, but everything will go very well.
That was Michael Sala, an advisor to French presidential candidate Marine Le Pen, speaking with Bloomberg's Caroline Conan. Hervé Mariton is a member of parliament and a prominent supporter of Republican François Fillon. He spoke with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix.
Give me a sense on whether you now think that there is no chance that Marine Le Pen becomes president. I keep on being told that she may be the first choice for certain people, but she wouldn't be the second choice of anyone else.
most of the other participants in the election will actually vote and ask for a vote in favor of Emmanuel Macron. I will personally vote in favor of Emmanuel Macron. I know some of our electorate will abstain, and this is legitimate, actually. I understand people who do not want to vote in favor of a candidate or a platform they would not support. But personally, I draw a comparison, and comparing the program of Marine Le Pen and that of Emmanuel Macron, I have the analysis that Marine Le Pen's program is the worst, and so I vote in favor of Emmanuel Macron. That's not a vote of enthusiasm, but it's a vote of comparison, and that will probably be the vote of many.
If you have either a low turnout or abstentions, it may play into Marine Le Pen's hands.
An election can always be lost. We have to keep that in mind. And so one cannot say today that it's sure that Emmanuel Macron will be elected. But I do believe that he's got a sound basis on the first round of the election, and that most of the electorate of other candidates will actually vote in favor of him. But abstention may be high. Marine Le Pen has small margins with other candidates. But, well, the obvious favorite of the second round is Emmanuel Macron.
Hervé Mariton, if we see Emmanuel Macron being president, what does it tell us about what happens in June? 11th and 18th, we have legislatives. Will your party, Les Républicains, form a coalition with him?
The Republican is not in the spirit of coalition presently. We believe we can get good results in the parliamentary election. We are presently with a political system where the Socialist Party has had very little score in the presidential election, but it has a very solid system in the country. We have the Mélenchon troops in the far left who got a very good result in the election. They will have good results in the parliamentary election as well. We've got the National Front, we've got the Macron people, we've got our own candidates. All this will be very complex, and nobody can guess the result of the parliamentary election.
That was French Parliament member Hervé Mariton speaking with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix. Coming up, a conversation with Italian Finance Minister Pier Carlo Padoan. You can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on Canada. It's on a roll, but to where? With Bloomberg's Dave Scanlon.
The situation.
Things have turned the corner. We've got a rebound in oil prices. We've got a slightly stimulative government that's spending to try and spark some more growth. And we've got just about free money still, unlike the United States. So those are all pulling together to boost growth here.
The background.
A lot of gold, there's potash, there's uranium, there's copper, a rich bounty really of resources in Canada, and that's why commodity prices are so important to the economic outlook for Canada.
The argument.
There's parts of the economy that are just not pulling along. We're seeing very weak business investment, for example. That's very important for the bank. Wages have not kept pace with growth, and inflation is nowhere to be seen. So the bank is looking at all that and saying, I don't think so.
For more on Canada or other quick takes, go to BloombergView.com/quicktake, or for terminal customers, go to NI Quick. I'm Charlie Pallett, Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm June Grosso. Pier Carlo Padoan is the finance minister of Italy. He spoke about the impact of the French elections with Bloomberg editor-in-chief John Micklethwaite.
Emmanuel Macron now very much in the driving seat. Does that mean France's problems are over?
Well, this is the first round, and of course, it's very good news. Let's wait for the second round. But having said that, this is good news for France, for Europe, and for the global economy, because France is set to embrace European targets and renew the European agenda.
And do you think that this could mean a reforming European Union? If you imagine you have Macron, maybe you have Schulz from Germany, could this mean a more integrated Eurozone than we've seen before?
More Europe is needed, not just for monetary union, which is of course a pillar of European integration, but also to reassure European citizens that Europe is also about growth and jobs, something which Europe has not been delivering very well recently on.
But do you think the problems to do with pushing that integration together, which you have always been a champion of, that those would be easier with Macron in the Elysee than it would have been with Hollande?
Europe needs a strong structural reform agenda. It needs to exploit much better the single market. And I'm convinced that Macron will use its political leadership, which appears to be strong, to deliver on those areas and in an integrated fashion.
And what do you think the prospects on Brexit are from this point of view? You've now got the British probably negotiating with Macron. How would you imagine he's different? You've worked for him for quite a long time.
Well, I imagine that negotiation will be on very clear terms, and that Europe will more easily reach a common negotiating position vis-a-vis Brexit.
And that will be a hard Brexit?
Well, maybe a clear Brexit without ambiguities.
I think that sounds fairly hard to me. maybe I can ask you a few questions on Italy. You've just had the Fitch, as we know, came out and downgraded Italy last week, partly on the back of political uncertainty or that element. Can you set the roadmap for the way in which you expect Italy to go ahead politically first?
Well, politically, this legislature is bound to end in February, and I am convinced that it will end in February. This is the time horizon of the current government, which still has a very ambitious reform agenda in addition to its fiscal adjustment agenda and growth agenda.
You wouldn't expect to see elections earlier than that?
That cannot be definitely fully ruled out at this stage. But as I said, the government does not assume to end its job before next February.
In terms of introducing competition, do you think Italy could embrace things like privatization more than it has done thus far?
Well, Italy continues to have an important privatization agenda. The numbers related to privatization are included in the document the government has recently approved only a week ago. So this continues to be on the agenda for several reasons: debt reduction, but also efficiency on the management pressures and diversification of financing sources for companies.
But can you see the way that when critics look at Italy, they sometimes say, look, you have a hand in appointing the heads of many of the biggest companies. Surely that's something that has to change.
Well, the privatization would not imply the government or the state giving up control of the management of the companies, but keeping the control, the amount of ownership that it's needed to ensure control. So from the point of view of the strategy, anything will hardly change.
Can you tell me a little bit about the banks in Italy? There's been a lot of noise and a lot of worries about individual bits. Monte Paschi, the banks in the Veneto. Which ones worry you most, and how do you see the path ahead on those?
Well, there are individual cases which are being dealt with, like Monte Paschi or the Veneto banks. There are individual cases which are have pursued an independent, successful strategy in terms of raising more capital, like UniCredit, and other banks are very strong, like Intesa. Then there is a general problem with the medium and smaller size banks, which are still holding in their budget NPLs to a large amount, which needs to be disposed of. So we need to continue encouraging these banks to make the best use of the existing new legislature, which speeds up significantly the conflict resolution problems in the credit market, and which could reduce the time needed to get rid of NPLs to a much shorter period.
That was Italian Finance Minister Pier Carlo Padoan speaking with Bloomberg Editor-in-Chief John Micklethwaite. And coming up, a conversation with United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. You can see all of Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
With a Bloomberg Business of Sports report, I'm Michael Barr. Players in the National Football League can sell their health data. The league reached a deal with Whoop that involves a wearable device. Whoop, based out of Boston, will distribute the wrist-worn strap to current and incoming NFL players to monitor their strain, recovery, and sleep. The sensors on the strap will transmit the information to mobile and web applications for analysis. The big-money baseball teams, like the New York Yankees and the Los Angeles Dodgers, are slashing their payroll and their luxury tax bills. According to the Associated Press, the Dodgers are on track to slice their tax bill by about 25% this year, the Yankees by about two-thirds. If a team does not pay tax in 2018, its tax rate would drop to 20% in 2019. What it would do is allow clubs to sign stars at a lower cost. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
Bloomberg Best is brought to you by National Realty, managers of New York City cash flow real estate, providing you 10 to 16% annualized returns with immediate monthly distributions. See them at nria.net. It's 48 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg View. Here's David Shipley.
President Trump's latest executive order calls on the U.S. to buy American and hire American. It calls for a review of the H-1B visa program to ensure that foreign workers in the U.S. don't drive down wages or put Americans out of work. And the order tells agencies to buy more domestically produced goods. The basic idea guiding Trump's approach is dangerously wrong. Economic interaction with the rest of the world isn't bad for America, it's good. The H-1B visa program is flawed, but the goal shouldn't be to reduce the inflow of skilled and needed foreigners. It should be to make sure the U.S. admits as many workers as possible who genuinely meet that test. Trump's thinking on Buy American is no smarter, though again, there's a germ of truth. The U.S. government is more open to foreign suppliers than other governments are to U.S. companies. Trump's mistake is to see raising U.S. barriers to trade as the answer. Far better to use the leverage of the U.S. market to force down barriers abroad. This editorial was written by the Bloomberg View editorial board. I'm David Shipley. For more View, please go to BloombergView.com and View Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Thank you, David. And now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Elisa Parenti. On KNX in Los Angeles, I'm reporting on concerns about Southern California-based Guitar Center's credit rating.
I'm Larry Kofsky, and on Bloomberg 99.1 in Washington, I'm reporting on Verizon's new ultra-fast internet service launching in D.C. and seven other East Coast markets.
I'm Courtney Dunahoe on KFAB in Omaha. Some Wells Fargo directors are in danger of being voted out at the company's shareholder meeting tomorrow.
I'm Ed Corey. On WWJ in Detroit, I'm reporting the Supreme Court has cleared the way for potentially billions of dollars in legal claims against General Motors.
I'm Gina Cervetti, and for WBBM in Chicago, I'm reporting that United Airlines has canceled CEO Oscar Munoz's expected elevation to chairman.
Thanks, Gina. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says there's no end in sight for the Syrian conflict, which is raising threat levels across the world. Guterres, who met with President Donald Trump at the White House, spoke with Bloomberg's Gina Smilek.
What did you discuss with Mr. Trump during that meeting?
Oh, we had the opportunity to discuss several of the most dramatic situations that we have in today's world that are a terrible threat to our peace and security, from North Korea to Syria to several other regions. And I think it's very important to recognize that in a world where we see this multiplication of conflicts, where old conflicts never die, in which conflicts are becoming more and more interlinked and linked to the problem of global terrorism, the engagement of the United States is very important. We do no longer live in a bipolar world or a unipolar world, but the truth is that for the most important problems of this world, there is no solution without a positive engagement and commitment of the United States.
Yeah, absolutely makes sense. Now, President Trump has signaled that he is not necessarily so supportive of the UN and that he might cut the budget of the UN. How do you convince President Trump, as the head of the UN, that it's a worthwhile organization and that it's something that the U.S. should maintain its commitment to? How do you sort of push back on his preconceived notions about it?
Well, first of all, he said also that the UN has a lot of potential, and I agree. And I think it's my role by reforming the UN to transform this potential into an even more effective reality. If one looks at today's dramas in the world, and if you look at the work my previous organizations, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNICEF, or the World Food Program, what they are doing as UN organizations, it is clear that they are irreplaceable. The whole humanitarian community, of course, is very important, the NGOs, the Red Cross, Red Crescent system, but UN agencies play an absolutely essential role in avoiding more death, more suffering, more tragedies in the world. On the other hand, if one looks at the dramatic situation in several countries, the UN peacekeepers, many of them dying for that, have been able to rescue many lives and to avoid the much worse situations of destabilization. There are many things that need to be reformed, and one of them is peacekeeping, and I'm intending to do a lot in making it more effective, in making sure that the situations of sexual exploitation and abuse are able to be eliminated, and that the blue helmets transform themselves always into a very important element for peace, for security, for the well-being of populations. But again, the UN peacekeeping costs 0.5% of the whole military expenditure. So we are talking of a very small amount of money that produces a lot of good. And the UN peacekeepers rescue lives. Many other military expenditures kill lives.
Absolutely. Now, that kind of segues us into the Syria conflict. Obviously, the issue in Syria on the ground hasn't been resolved. Has the multinational community dropped the ball on Syria?
No. We are committed, and the UN is committed to maintain a strong effort, a strong push for a political solution. The solution is political. We need a political solution. We need the Syrian people to be able to decide on their destiny freely, without interference of anybody. But for that political solution to be possible, we need to make sure that all those that have an influence to the parties to the conflict understand that this now became a war in which nobody is winning, everybody is losing. That has terribly destabilized the region. Look at Iraq and the Mosul situation. And that has dramatically contributed to the increase in terrorism in the world. And it's threatening the lives of all of us, everywhere. So even if the countries that have supported the parties of the conflict have different interests, different perspectives about the future of Syria, now the danger for us all is so big. And our common interest is so clearly to stop this war that I hope that our pressure will be able to produce results, and that I hope that finally the international community will be able to come together and put an end to this horrible conflict. And the Syrian people is suffering in a way that is absolutely unacceptable.
Now, you're at the very start of your tenure at the United Nations. What are your biggest priorities and largest goals during your time?
I have essentially two priorities. First, to reform the organization, to make it more effective, more cost-effective, more nimble, more able to respond to the expectations of the general population. We are going to do it in the management, to making it simplified, decentralized, more flexible, with more transparency and accountability. We're going to do it with the UN development system to make it more coordinated and also more accountable, especially now that we have the sustainable development goals that want to promote supporting governments all over the world. We have our peace and security architecture that needs to be improved. But beyond the reform, which is an internal question, I would say my main objective is to be useful, to be an added value in helping member states to create conditions for conflicts to be solved and for new conflicts to be prevented. The reason why I applied for this job was because I've been 10 years High Commissioner for Refugees. And I think I've seen the suffering of the most vulnerable of the vulnerable people in the world. And you can't imagine how frustrating it is to see these tragedies and not to be able to solve them. We can improve the situation of people, we can help them cope with their tragedy, but to solve the problem, we need political solutions.
And do you see a sign that political solutions are on the way in Syria in particular? You know, do you see a light at the end of the tunnel in that situation?
We are very far from the end of the tunnel. We need to be able, as I mentioned, to convince all those that have an influence in the situation in Syria that this conflict must end. And it is in the vital interest of all the actors to end the conflict, because they are all losing and they are putting the lives of their citizens everywhere in the world in danger.
What role does the UN play in convincing all the actors in that situation that that's the case?
First of all, we need to constantly act with them, advocate for the need to engage in a peace process in Syria, and at the same time to everything to mobilize the public opinion, to mobilize the civil societies, for them to put pressure on governments in order for governments to understand that indeed this is the moment to stop this carnage.
What, if anything, would you want to communicate with the American administration when it comes to the Paris Agreement?
Well, I think that the Paris Agreement was a very important step forward. But I think that what today the fight against climate change represents is not only, in my opinion, a need to preserve our future, to preserve our earth, but it's also good business. Green business is good business.
That was United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking with Bloomberg's Gina Smilek. That's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best. If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. Our show is produced by David Sucherman, Reginald Bazile, and Richard Truman. I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.